Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. The recent monkeypox outbreak started in May and hasn't slowed down. Coming up, we learn more about this virus, from how it spreads to who is eligible for vaccination. Dr. Celine Gounder joins us. She's senior fellow at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Now, what questions do you have about monkeypox? You can join us, 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WMPR. Or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. That conversation coming up in a few minutes. First, Connecticut Mirror's Mark Pasniokas called it. On Monday, he told Where We Live it would be a sleepy primary due to low voter turnout. But many were surprised by the upset in the three-way Republican primary for U.S. Senate. Leora Levy beating one of the more prominent Republicans in the state, former House Minority Leader Themis Claridis, who was also the party's endorsed candidate. She beat her by 10 percentage points. Now, Governor Lamont, who's running against Bob Stefanowski, put it this way.
I was surprised to some degree by what happened last night. I was surprised that a Donald Trump made such a difference in a Republican Party. And as you point out, I think he has an exclusionary type of politics. You're with me or against me. I think he's divisive. I think he leaves a lot of people behind, including the independents and moderate Republicans that you just referenced.
Now, Connecticut Public's Matt Dwyer was at Leora Levy's headquarters primary night and said Levy appeared stunned by Tuesday night's victory when she appeared before a cheering crowd of supporters in her hometown of Greenwich. Now, just days prior, she was endorsed by former President Donald Trump while at a Republican town committee event. And on Monday, Trump joined Levy on a phone call the same day his Mar-a-Lago estate was searched by the FBI as part of an investigation into whether he took classified records from the White House to his Florida residence. Now, Levy made a point to bring Trump up during her victory speech.
Thank you, President Trump, for your strong, clear, unequivocal endorsement, your belief in me. You know, I'm so honored that you have chosen to support me and that you to have your confidence, and I will not let you down.
And now she moves on to face longtime incumbent Democratic U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal. Joining us now on Zoom is Wesley Renfro, who's professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. Wesley, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
So there's been a lot of talk about how this Trump endorsement of Leora Levy may have helped her in this summer primary. What are your thoughts here?
So I think it's very fair to say that it certainly didn't hurt her. It's a little difficult to tease out the impact of the primary because, frankly, the endorsement, because, you know, there was no polling in this primary. And we were sort of going by gut feelings and name recognition. But when we look sort of empirically at the weight of Trump's endorsements, you know, they do sometimes align with the winning candidate, but especially recently, there have been a number of somewhat notable non-endorsed candidates that have prevailed against Trump-endorsed candidates. So overall, the record's a little bit mixed, and it's hard to say with certainty in this particular case.
There's also a lot of scrutiny, of course, on the fact that Connecticut's primary happens the second week of August. Again, vacation time. We know that unaffiliateds definitely outnumber Democrats and Republicans in our state. And so when we think about who's showing up to vote, it's most likely the partisans that are coming out. And that's why we see low numbers, Wes?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Low turnout elections, and this is certainly one of them, you know, really favor folks who are politicos, who are into party politics at state and local levels. And so I think that the types of GOP voters who showed up on Tuesday are the folks who are generally most receptive to a Trump endorsement. And so I think it's sort of this combination of, you know, Trump endorsement plus who showed up in what numbers at the polls that explains this upset.
And what about the candidate herself? When we think about candidate quality, this is someone that appealed to the conservative base. You know, several years ago, she was a Jeb Bush supporter. She's made previous remarks against Donald Trump back then. Even her opinion has changed on abortion. And so I'm wondering if you can reconcile all of that into how Republican voters are looking at her today.
So I think there's two things embedded in your question. And the first is overall candidate quality. And the second is sort of her evolution with different policies over time. On the first, I think that she's a quite good candidate. She has a compelling personal story. I think one that resonates especially with conservative voters. She speaks well. I think that overall she ran a pretty good campaign. It is true that this is a person who in the not so recent past had much more moderate GOP policy positions. She's someone who I believe was previously pro-choice and who in 2015, 2016 was not a supporter of Donald Trump. All that being said, you know, post 2016, we see a remaking of the Republican Party in which many folks who were never Trumpers have happily hopped on the Trump train and show no signs of exiting. And voters seem to have largely forgotten that. I think this election is a snapshot in time, what she says now and not what she said, you know, 5 or 10 years ago.
And when we think about the Republican Party, what about Connecticut's Republican Party? What does this say? The endorsed candidate, of course, was a moderate, Themis Claridis. She did not prevail in this primary. And now wondering what your thoughts on, you know, how the party comes together when we think about, you know, the makeup of this party. And again, for those Republicans who may see themselves as moderates in the state of Connecticut, also many who are unaffiliated.
So there's certainly more strife in the Republican Party now than there has been for a couple years. And I think we see that nationally and also in Connecticut. You know, Connecticut has a long history of sort of more moderate Republican politics, although in the past couple years, there's certainly been a strong populist, pro-Trump, harder right element to the party. I'm a little reluctant to say that based on these quite low turnout numbers that the entire party is entirely aligned with Trump. I think there are a lot of more moderate, perhaps more socially liberal, but fiscally conservative Republican-leaning individuals in the state. I'm not sure that they showed up on Tuesday, but I think it is a signal that enthusiasm among sort of diehard Trump supporters remains very high.
I saw a tweet on primary night I wanted to share because the flip side is how Democrats are seeing the outcome of this three-way Republican race for U.S. Senate. Someone tweeted, Blumenthal won't have to spend two nickels to be reelected. Your thoughts on Leora Levy's chances here in November, Wes?
Yeah, I think they're slim. Frankly, I think that Themis Claridis's chances were also on the slim side, though not as slim as Leora's. You know, there's certainly an incumbency advantage. There are far more Democrats than there are Republicans in the state, although there are a significant number of unaffiliated voters. This is a place that hasn't elected a Republican to the Senate in a long time. Richard Blumenthal is well-known, has a lot of name recognition. Although this nationally, I think, will be a pretty good year for Republicans, I don't think his seat was ever in a lot of danger, and I think that it's in less danger now than it would have been had the outcome swung the other way.
You mentioned Republicans haven't held a seat in Connecticut for some time. CT News Junkie reported that since 1982, a Republican has not held a U.S. Senate seat in Connecticut. You know, moving on to some of the other primary races that we saw on the Democratic side, you know, a few years ago, there was a lot of attention on the fact that Connecticut hasn't had any state constitutional officers of color except former Treasurer Denise Napier. You know, this year's primary could change that. So what was your take on who ran in the Secretary of the State race and the Treasurer's race on the Democratic side and who prevailed?
You know, so Stephanie Thomas, I think, was the favorite on the Democratic side and is, you know, a representative of color. I think there's been a lot of mobilization in those communities, certainly nationally and also locally. I think she ran a good campaign and that's really reflected in a pretty lopsided victory. On the state treasurer, I think it's in some ways the same story. Eric Russell is both a person of color and I believe a member of the LGBTQ community, who ran a good campaign, had some party endorsements, is well known. And it's nice to see that we have some representation.
Now, of course, all eyes on the general election in November. Certainly, the outcome or the expectation, there'll be much greater turnout when we think about, you know, national issues. For the primary, I believe about 15% of state Democrats turned up to vote, and it was 21% on the Republican side. And so what will you be looking for in the next few months in this campaign season, Wes?
You know, I'm looking to see if there's much action at all. I mean, the November ballot here, I think, will be relatively sleepy for some of the reasons that I cited before, including Democrat incumbents. I also think that some of the things that have motivated folks in places like Kansas, right, sort of post-Dobbs furor over abortion and other social issues, might motivate voters, but because they are not in doubt, at least at the state level in Connecticut, I'm not entirely sure how they will play out. So I'm anticipating sort of a quiet electoral cycle, but I'll be on the lookout for upsets and things that might make it a little bit more exciting.
And I want to plug Connecticut Public is going to be hosting several debates in the congressional and Senate races, as well as some of these statewide races. And so you can learn more in the coming weeks, and we hope our listeners check that out as well. I want to thank Wesley Renfro for being on Where We Live to do a little bit of a primary wrap-up for us. Again, he's professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. Wes, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, we're going to pivot to monkeypox and public health emergency. What questions do you have? You can join us, 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WMPR. Share a comment on Facebook or find us on Twitter at Where We Live.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Hartford HealthCare recently celebrated the opening of the Ridge Recovery Center in Windham. Christy Scott, Vice President of Clinical Operations, describes this new state-of-the-art destination for healing.
Individuals will come if they're suffering from substance use disorder and get individualized treatment. They can stay up to 3 to 4 weeks and receive family therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, and lots of other holistic care like yoga, trail walking, acupuncture. So it's going to be a great place for people to come and heal.
For those seeking recovery, finding it close to home can sometimes be challenging.
Many individuals travel to Florida and other states that have more treatment centers, so we're hoping by doubling our capacity at Hartford HealthCare, the individuals can stay in their home state with their family and support systems close by.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Top federal health officials say monkeypox is a public health emergency after cases of monkeypox, a rare disease, continues to spread here and in more than 50 countries. As of this morning, the Centers for Disease Control says there are nearly 10,400 confirmed cases in the U.S. In Connecticut, 54 cases have been confirmed. Now, coming up, we'll learn about how Connecticut organizations are responding, including our state government, when we talk about vaccine access and education about monkeypox. Now, what questions do you have? You can join us, 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WMPR. You can share a comment on Facebook or find us on Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us now on Zoom is Dr. Celine Gounder. She's senior fellow at the Kaiser Family Foundation, an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist, and she was a member of the Biden-Harris Transition COVID Advisory Board. Dr. Gounder, welcome to our show.
It's great to be here.
Now, I mentioned at the top that this is a rare disease, and so can you give us a little bit of history of monkeypox and then update us on how this outbreak started?
I don't think people paid all that much attention to monkeypox until after its close cousin smallpox was eradicated. And it's because the presentation of those illnesses were fairly similar, could also be confused with chickenpox, where you get these pustules all over the body and then they scab over. The good news is monkeypox is not nearly as deadly as smallpox, but we really started to become more aware of it after smallpox was eradicated in 1980. And at that time, it was largely being transmitted it was largely infecting young children in West Africa and Central Africa. And the thought was that they were coming into contact with wildlife, probably rodents, that were infected with monkeypox, perhaps playing outdoors, that sort of thing. And it was pretty sporadic. There was very low level of transmission within a household. Prior studies showed probably less than 10% of cases led to transmission to others in the household. And then you start to see a new pattern emerge around 2016, 2017. And this is in Nigeria, where you start to see the demographics change. So it becomes men who are in their 20s and 30s, much more in urban areas all of a sudden. And many of them are professionals, as opposed to previously being kids, rural, poor. And what we're realizing in retrospect is that this was the beginning of transmission, sexual transmission among men who have sex with men. Gay sex is illegal in Nigeria. And so this unfortunately went under the radar for several years. Some people did try to flag this, but it by and large went under the radar until there was spillover into other populations, starting with Europe and then, of course, the U.S. and other countries around the world this year.
Now, why has it now been declared a public health emergency? At what point, when we think about that this is a something that needs to have that designation, Dr. Gounder?
Well, a few things. One, we're seeing exponential growth in cases, so they're really rising quite rapidly. And we know that, you know, you mentioned the 10,000 number of cases in the U.S. That's definitely an underestimate. We're under-diagnosing, under-testing for a whole host of reasons, and so the true numbers are significantly higher. And some people might say, well, you know, I'm not at risk, so why should I care? I think that's actually really short-sighted, because it's only a matter of time before you do have spillover into other populations. This is an infectious disease that right now is largely being driven by sexual transmission, but there are other ways this disease can be transmitted. It involves close skin-to-skin contact, and there are other forms of skin-to-skin contact. For example, a caregiver, whether that's a day caregiver or somebody working in a nursing home, also has intimate contact, skin-to-skin contact that's not sexual but could lead to transmission. And so we are concerned that there will eventually be spillover. If you look at other infectious diseases, let's say HIV, which is similar in that it can be sexually transmitted, but it may also be transmitted in other ways, for example, from mother to child or through needles, through blood transfusions. And so this is something that is, one, it is a major public health issue for gay and bisexual men and trans women, but it's also critical that we contain it as quickly as possible, because it could become a real public health threat to other populations as well.
When we think about the tools that public health officials have, like yourself, Dr. Gounder, as an epidemiologist and infectious disease specialist, and again, the fact that the World Health Organization and now the U.S. Calling this a public health emergency, you know, when we think about the tools, so testing, lack of maybe access to the vaccine, is it fair to say that we should not have gotten to this point where we now have to declare a public health emergency? I'm wondering if you can peel back the curtain here.
Yeah, so, you know, there's also been a similar conversation in COVID, right? We have the tools, quote unquote. Well, it doesn't really help you to have the tools if you're not implementing, if you're not making use of the tools, if people can't access the tools. So if people are not able to access providers who can make the diagnosis, who are willing to get them tested, to get them treatment, if we don't have the supply of vaccine to get everybody vaccinated, and if people are just not also informed and aware, the tools, quote unquote, are not going to really have much of an impact. And so we are seeing a lot of barriers in terms of providers not testing as much as they should be. Some of that was due to inadequate laboratory capacity early on. That has mostly been fixed now, but it's also a lot of, it's really tedious, frankly, for a medical provider to get all of the different specimens. You have to fill out a lab requisition slip for every single swab you take. You have to send that off to the lab, and that takes a lot of time. So in some cases, some providers are preferring to wait until they send off other easier things to test for first. In terms of the treatment, that's also a lot of paperwork. There's this drug called TPOXX, and not everybody's willing to do the paperwork. And then with the vaccines, we really do have a short supply and are trying to figure out how to spread that short supply as widely as we can.
When you mentioned vaccines, the New York Times reporting earlier this month that the federal government's now distributing about 1.1 million doses. That's less than a third of what health officials estimate is needed to fight the outbreak. And I believe the next delivery, 500,000 doses, not expected until September or October, Dr. Gounder. What more can you tell us?
Yeah, so it's also a two-dose vaccine. And so what we want to do is, at the very least, reach the highest risk among men who have sex with men. And so those would be those who are having anonymous sex partners, who are having multiple sex partners, who maybe already have HIV, who have had known contacts with monkeypox cases. Those are going to be the people at highest risk. But at the same time, so those are the numbers that are used when the CDC makes estimates of how much vaccine we need. The problem is many more people than that are actually trying to get vaccinated. That's what I just described, that highest risk group is probably only a fraction of all men who have sex with men. And yet you have many other gay and bisexual men and trans women who are stepping up wanting to get vaccinated. And so you really have to multiply sort of that number by several fold to meet that need.
You're hearing Dr. Celine Gounder, senior fellow at the Kaiser Family Foundation. She's an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist as we talk about the monkeypox outbreak and learning more about this virus. If you have questions, you can join us 888-720-9677 or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We've spent some time talking on the policy end of this, but in terms of breaking it down for our listeners about the symptoms of monkeypox, could you tell us more?
Sure. The most common symptoms are going to be fever, enlarged lymph nodes. So that could be in the neck, it could be in the armpit, the groin. Those are the most common places to have enlarged lymph glands, lymph nodes. And then the rash, the characteristic rash. And so that rash generally starts with flat red spots on the skin or on mucosal surfaces. Those then become fluid-filled blisters, which then evolve into pus-filled pustules that look like pimples, and then those break open and scab over, and then you have new skin that grows up underneath. And it's not until the scabs fall off and you have new skin growth underneath that you're considered no longer infectious or contagious to other people. Those lesions can be really anywhere on the body or on mucosal surfaces. So mucosal surfaces include the eye, the inside the nose, inside the mouth, parts of the genitalia, and the anus. And what we're seeing in particular with this outbreak is because it's sexually transmitted, it's the parts of the body that people have close contact during sex. So we're seeing lesions in or around the mouth, the genitalia, and the anus. And some of those lesions are exceedingly painful. And so we're seeing patients who are requiring hospital admission just for pain control.
And are those symptoms typical for people who contract monkeypox? Is it possible that you could have it and not show a certain rash? I'm just wondering if you can talk about that.
Yeah, and this is something we're still trying to figure out. Is there such a thing as asymptomatic monkeypox, so monkeypox without symptoms? And if so, how common is that? And we just don't know. There do seem to be people who have very mild symptoms and who may confuse their symptoms with maybe a herpes outbreak or not even thinking that there's anything wrong. And so that is going to require more research, screening, testing of people to figure out if that truly does happen, and if so, how frequently it could happen, somebody could be infected without symptoms.
Now, if you do get monkeypox, how long do these symptoms last? How long does someone have to quarantine before they're not contagious anymore, Dr. Gounder?
Yeah, it ranges. Anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks. You know, if you think about, you have these skin lesions that you have to have break open, scab over, and then have new skin growth underneath. Some of these can take a while to heal. And so it's really challenging. You know, people have trouble isolating for COVID for 5 days. I mean, think about 4 weeks of isolation. That's a pretty heavy lift for a lot of people. And it's even harder if you have to then, for example, disclose to your employer, I have monkeypox and I need 4 weeks off to isolate. So we do need to have better systems to support people to do the right thing and isolate without fear of issues at work and being able still to collect wages.
Hmm. That sounds problematic when we think about the last 2.5 years, Dr. Gounder. Those systems weren't even in place for people with COVID. And now we're looking at this other public health emergency. You know, how concerned are you here?
I am concerned. You know, we are one of the few developed countries in the world that does not have paid sick and family medical leave for everyone. And that's really what it would take to expect people to truly take time off work or from time off school or keep kids home, for example, if they happen to have an infection. You really need to provide people with the support to make that possible so that they don't have to choose between their livelihood, their wages. It's not going to cost them something to do the right thing and isolate.
Again, you can join us if you have a question about monkeypox, 888-720-9677. We heard Dr. Gounder talk about the population that is most impacted right now, men having sex with men. But as you have said, Dr. Gounder, a few times now, anyone can get monkeypox. And so I'm wondering if you can talk more about how people should be, whether they should be concerned if it can be spread through sharing services like a public bathroom or with school just around the corner. And we know how viruses spread from one child to the next. And so how concerned should we be?
Yeah, I think people are perhaps a bit paranoid about the kinds of exposures that can lead to transmission. So it's not from sitting on a toilet seat or touching a doorknob or a faucet. It does require significant exposure, direct skin-to-skin contact or skin-to-mucosal contact. It does require enough virus exposure for long enough. And so that's just not going to happen with those sort of casual exposures, sitting next to somebody on the subway, that kind of thing. And in terms of kids at school, where the risk is going to be highest is really at the daycare youngest kid age group, where you may have childcare providers who say are changing diapers and, really attending to the kids' physical and hygienic needs, as opposed to, a teacher in the classroom is not going to have that kind of contact with students.
I guess I'm thinking of, a family that has children of multiple ages. You know, if a child were to get it in a child care facility, they have older siblings. And so, what parents and providers should be looking for, Dr. Gounder?
Yeah, so in terms of the risk, based on the studies we've seen in from Central and Western Africa, where, as I mentioned, earlier on, it was largely in young kids. And even then, it was only in about 10% of cases that initial infection in that first kid would get transmitted to anybody else in the household. So it is relatively low risk. It's pretty inefficient in terms of transmission as opposed to the sexual transmission that we're currently seeing. And what should parents be looking for? It's the same symptoms. So it would be the fever, the swollen lymph glands, the skin rash, which, as I mentioned earlier, could be confused with chickenpox. That's probably what it most looks like for parents who are familiar with that. Could also be confused with herpes. So having this rash of initially red spots that evolve into eventually pimples and then scab over, that, if you see anything that resembles that, to talk to your pediatrician to get your child tested would be the wise thing to do. But big picture, if people are washing hands, they practice good hygiene, it's going to be very low risk for transmission in the household.
Again, we're learning more about monkeypox. You can join us, 888-720-9677. Coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to hear more about how Connecticut officials and nonprofits are working to educate people about monkeypox as well as provide the vaccine to those populations that need it the most right now. Earlier this week, we've been talking a lot about some of the symptoms, and that includes looking for a rash, Dr. Gounder. But we'd heard on Connecticut Public, a Yale infectious disease expert saying that people should just avoid contact with strange-looking rashes. And we were wondering, does that stigmatize individuals that might already have a rash for something completely unrelated to monkeypox? There was this high-profile story of a woman that had a skin condition and people taking pictures and posting it on TikTok. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that.
Yeah, this is a woman with neurofibromatosis, which is a genetic condition. It is not infectious. And so that was highly stigmatizing, accusing this woman of having monkeypox and putting other people at risk. And she simply did not have an infectious condition, monkeypox or otherwise. I don't think the lay public should take it upon themselves to be Dr. Google and try to diagnose other people. Even me as a medical provider, just looking at it, I can't necessarily make that diagnosis. I really would need to take some swabs, send that to the lab, ask them to test for monkeypox as well as, some other possibilities. And without that, it's really hard to give a definitive diagnosis. There are any number of conditions that can cause rashes that are not infectious, everything from psoriasis to eczema to cancer. And so just because somebody has something on their skin doesn't mean it's monkeypox.
And what about concern? When I talk about stigma, how this has been discussed in the media, in the public, and how this disease could further stigmatize or cause discrimination in the LGBTQ population.
Well, we've already seen some of that. We've seen some members of the LGBTQ community assaulted already. And harassed because of monkeypox. And I think that really speaks to fear of the unknown. And what we see in infectious disease outbreak after infectious disease outbreak is marginalized communities getting blamed and scapegoated for that outbreak. And we saw this most recently prior to monkeypox with COVID. Early in the COVID pandemic, early in 2020, we saw Asian Americans being harassed and attacked and blamed for the COVID pandemic.
We just have a few minutes left. Dr. Celine Gounder, again, senior fellow at the Kaiser Family Foundation. She's an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist. I had mentioned there are nearly 10,400 confirmed cases. You said that that's an underestimation. There's probably more in the U.S. In Connecticut, we've got, I think, 54 cases that have been confirmed. I mean, what are you going to be watching for in the next few weeks? And should we expect that the numbers are going to continue to grow? Or is public health going to be able to be on top of this in terms of getting that vaccine and testing available in the next month or so?
I do expect the numbers will grow. If you look at the pattern in the UK, it does seem that the growth has peaked and is now coming down. And how much of that is related to behavior change versus vaccination is important, because if it's behavior change, I mean, as we know with COVID, people can change their behavior for a period of time, but it may not stick in the long run. So you might be able to get people to mask, for example, for a month or a couple months. But a lot of people after a few months were really tired of doing that and stopped. And so similarly, you might be able to get people to change their sexual behaviors for some period of time, but not indefinitely. And so what we're very much looking out for with the UK, and for that matter, the US, is do you see this dropping or a peak and then decreasing transmission? Is that because of other things like vaccination, or is it really just behavior change? And that will predict how things continue to evolve. I think the other thing that's already been very concerning is if you look at the cases of monkeypox, they are disproportionately among men of color, men who have sex with men who are men of color. And they are not the ones who, by and large, are getting vaccinated. And so we're already seeing a huge disparity between those who are truly impacted getting infected and those who are getting vaccinated. And so that is a disparity we're very concerned about, particularly given vaccines remain in shortage for the months.
Again, you've been hearing Dr. Celine Gounder here on the show, senior fellow at the Kaiser Family Foundation. I should mention she's also editor-at-large for public health at Kaiser Health News, which is a great resource. Thank you for spending time with us today, Dr. Gounder. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. Coming up, we're going to hear about access to the monkeypox vaccine in our state and how local groups are responding to improve access as well as educate people about monkeypox. You can join us 888-720-9677 or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/TAP support. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In Community Speaker Series May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speaker series. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. You're listening to Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. Today, we're learning more about the monkeypox virus as cases continue to grow in the U.S. and in Connecticut. Joining our conversation now on Zoom is Kay Perkins, who's a reporter with Connecticut Public Radio. Kay's been covering this story from the Connecticut angle. Kay, welcome to our show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And so what has the outbreak looked like in Connecticut?
Well, there haven't been a ton of cases. As you said earlier, we have over 50 right now, but the growth is not nearly as extreme as it was, for example, COVID. But obviously, a lot of people are still very concerned.
We heard Dr. Gounder earlier talking about spillover and how this moved from Europe then to the U.S. So when we think about how we're located, Kay, so close to New York and that being an epicenter, and that's why we're seeing these cases now coming over to Connecticut, what are officials talking about in terms of this outbreak?
Right. U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal talked a bit about this last week at a press conference. He spoke about the fact that, as we saw with COVID, when there is a disease spreading in New York, obviously you've got people commuting in from Connecticut or just traveling in between New York and Connecticut. We usually find a lot of spillover into Connecticut. So obviously officials are pretty concerned about that.
And as far as access to vaccine, what can you tell us in terms of how much supply there is in Connecticut and who's able to access it, Kate?
Right. So there are about 4,000 doses that have been allocated for Connecticut. It's important to remember that it's a two-dose vaccine. So that's about 2,000 people who could be covered by the vaccine. About 700 have been administered so far, and there are about 3,500 doses remaining. And obviously, this is just not enough to cover the number of people who would want to get vaccinated. Mm-hmm. As of right now, the administration efforts are focused on, again, men having sex with men, also trans women, gender non-conforming people, and non-binary people. And they are concentrating distribution for people who are very sexually active, having, you know, two or more sex partners within the last 14 days or having anonymous sex partners, you know, but again, that those are not the only people who can contract monkeypox. So it's really the vaccine supply is just not enough to fight the outbreak.
And we think about how to get the vaccine, state public health officials are relying on nonprofits and health clinics to get that to residents, Kay?
Right. There's about 13 vaccine and testing clinics across the state. A lot of them are clinics that have already worked with LGBT folks specifically. But again, only 13 spots across the state, not necessarily as readily accessible as we might like.
You're hearing Kay Perkins on the show. She's a reporter with Connecticut Public as we talk about monkeypox in Connecticut and how officials are getting the vaccine out to residents. Connecticut Public recently spoke with Christopher Marsala, who was getting the monkeypox vaccine at the Fairhaven Community Healthcare. Let's hear what he had to say.
But as soon as I saw that first clinic pop up, I just really wanted to get an appointment just because I feel very grateful that there's a lot of community healthcare available to many populations across the state, and especially just knowing that it's critical to be part of the solution and being able to have empowered agency with healthcare, that makes me feel really great. Just knowing, you know what, I can come in, I have the resources and community support to get a vaccine, it's really huge. Mm-hmm.
So you'd said earlier, Kay, that there are about 13 clinics that have the vaccine. Is it expected? What are you hearing from public health officials in our state? You know, could this vaccine be available at a primary care doctor office?
Isn't enough of the vaccine for that to happen? With only 3,500 doses, you know, if you divide that up by 13 clinics, that's, you know, a couple hundred doses per clinic. So there just isn't enough supply right now. I know that Richard Blumenthal mentioned that the federal government said that once that vaccine supply that we currently have has been exhausted, they will send more. But as of right now, I don't think we can expect primary care physicians to have the vaccine.
Right. And the federal government saying that another shipment of this vaccine not expected till September, even October. Kay Perkins is with us. And joining us now is Linda Estabrook, who's executive director of the Hartford Gay and Lesbian Health Collective. Linda, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Lucy. Glad to be here.
Tell us about how your organization is working to get the vaccine to people that you serve.
So this is a day-to-day prospect and for all of us who are getting the vaccine to administer in the state. We don't necessarily know day-to-day or week-to-week how much vaccine we'll be getting to then be able to schedule people to for them to get the vaccine. So as I said, it's a day-to-day thing. And so we have to visit our scheduling and our availability. Last week we had maxed out. This week we do have more vaccine. Each of the sites in the state gets vaccine from a designated hospital, and the designated hospital gets their supply determined from the Department of Public Health in the state and also the CDC. And so while there, we had conversations earlier this week about setting up an acquisition schedule for a certain number of doses to plan on each week. The hospital doesn't know how many doses they're getting, and so they can't plan, we can't plan. So we do the best with our planning and getting schedules set up to give people the vaccine.
Are you hearing a lot of response from the community, people who want it and are calling you? Or I'm just wondering if you can talk about that, Linda.
Yes. So Monday morning of last week, and actually even some days before, people started calling us. And our phone lines got jammed. And we're in the process of adding actually additional phone lines so that we can not only take care of incoming calls, but outgoing calls. And it took until the beginning of this week for us to get through the backlog of like well over 150 voice messages from people calling to want to schedule to get a vaccine. One of the things that we're making clear to people is there are multiple sites, and if you can't get an appointment with us that works for you, contact other sites. and find a location and find a time that can work for you to be able to get the vaccine. But it slowed some this week, but we still have, we're still getting calls and people wanted to be vaccinated. But there was that initial influx last week that like, wow, this is a lot to handle all at once. So, but we've made our way through that.
How do people know where to go or who to call, Linda? You'd mentioned if people are looking for the vaccine, is there a place online where that information is available? I'm wondering if you can tell our listeners more there.
The state of Connecticut Department of Public Health has part of their website that is devoted to monkeypox, and including vaccines and where to get vaccines. And so they're maintaining a list there. And we have links from our site to the Department of Public Health site so that people can find information, through us too. We were able to set up a monkeypox, page on our website. It's hglhc.org. And so we're working to maintain that website as, up to date as possible, you know, given the regular changes that happen. And so we have some information that is a little bit distilled down versus you can get, you know, pages of information from health departments and from the CDC that it takes a while to like read through. Mm-hmm. So we're just putting the highlights along with links. And when people call us, we're as needed, we're redirecting them to the other sites that we know are providing the vaccine.
And Linda, we'll be sure to share those links as well at where we live. We just have a couple of minutes left. Something that Dr. Celine Gounder shared before we said goodbye to her is that when we think about who is contracting a monkeypox, she said men having sex with men, people of color, and there's a problem with, again, vaccine access. And so I'm wondering if you can talk about that from your perspective.
There are the requirements, the criteria in Connecticut in order to receive the vaccine. If you have had a known exposure, somebody who tested positive for monkeypox, you're a priority person. And then as the doctor was mentioning, the various criteria of having multiple or anonymous sexual partners in the last 14 days. The vaccine is it takes time for it to be effective. It's not an immediate fix, and that's a really important educational piece that needs to get out there over and over and over again, that it takes two shots. And if you're getting one shot today and then another shot in 4 weeks, it's not until 2 weeks after that that you become what's considered to have a be fully effective. And so it doesn't protect people immediately. You can't get the vaccine today and be safe, in quotes, for taking a trip someplace to, you know, people are going to P-Town for the weekend. This is not going to take care of this. Prevention is still a really important and best way to avoid getting monkeypox. And so we have to get all of those messages out to people, because there isn't enough vaccine available, as the doctor was saying. If everybody's getting two shots, it limits the number of people. And so that's why there are limitations, and it not just being broadly put out there as like a pre-exposure prophylaxis type of treatment. It's an after a for sure exposure or a presumed exposure.
And when you talk about the emphasis on prevention, and so important to bring awareness about monkeypox without stigmatizing men having sex with men, Linda, you know, how you're getting mm-hmm. that message across?
It can be a balance and a fine line. And at it's important to let people know that you are in a population that is at risk because of various behaviors and interactions. And like one of our first messages that we put out there weeks ago, if you are close enough with somebody to be able to get syphilis or gonorrhea, you're close enough to get monkeypox. And people need to pay attention to who they're involved with sexually, intimately, and you know what this disease can look like. But it's just by looking at, as the doctor was saying earlier about the lay public, you know, it's, this disease is not presenting in a consistent way, even for the medical professionals. So the lay public, whether they're trying to protect themselves or, you know, she was talking about the people with more hate in their hearts than anything else and cruelty, you know, they're not going to be able to diagnose this from afar either. And so we have to give out consistent messages. One of the things that we started to do this week is with everybody that we're providing the vaccine to, we're following up with a phone call in a couple of days. So how are you? How, you know, how's it going? Reminder that they need to refrain.
That's really good to hear, Linda. You know? That follow-up is important. Unfortunately, yes. We're out of time, but I do appreciate your time on the show. Linda Estabrook, Executive Director of the Hartford Gay and Lesbian Health Collective. Also thanks to Kay Perkins, reporter with Connecticut Public, for joining us. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today's show produced by Tess Terrible with help from Anya Grandolski.